You are now listening to Macrodose.
Hello and welcome to Macrodose, a podcast hosted by me, James Meadway, that brings you your weekly fix of everything economics in a quick 15-minute roundup. Each Wednesday morning, we bring you the key stories making the news and the analysis you need to make sense of them. Today, on Wednesday afternoon, we're bringing you something a bit different because it's Budget Day here in the UK, a day in which the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt lays out his plans for perhaps a not a very long period of time before the next election. Joining me to discuss what we've just seen from Jeremy Hunt and perhaps how Labour is going to respond to this is Stella Chedikidou, who is a former Labour Party advisor and head of policy for the criminal justice charity Catch 22. So today's budget was when Jeremy Hunt and the Conservative government were going to lay out their plans for perhaps how to win and get hold of a fifth term in office for the party in power. It seems a bit unlikely, and all things considered, having just sat through Jeremy Hunt's speech and its smattering of weak jokes and the usual sort of backwards and forwards between the political parties of no great interest to anyone outside of Westminster, there really wasn't very much there, apart from a heavily trailed 2p reduction in the rate of national insurance contributions. Now, national insurance contributions is basically another tax on your income for most people in work, so it excludes pensioners rather pointedly, and excludes those on particularly low rates of pay. 2p off that means about £400 on average for a person in work in Britain. But that average varies a fair bit. If you're an MP, because you're actually paid more, the tax cut is worth more. You get about 750 quid. If you're a starting nurse on a starting salary, that's about £300 you're going to get. It's kind of inherently a bit unfair. And of course, if you're a pensioner, you're not going to see any real difference from this whatsoever. Total cost in 5 years' time, £10 billion. So that's £10 billion for this sort of slightly cack-handed pre-election giveaway, the thing that all the Conservative backbenchers at least were clamouring for. Because, of course, out there in the real world, you go and look at the opinion polls and you find that two-thirds of people surveyed in Britain say they would rather see increased spending on public services than tax cuts. And, of course, what they get in this government is something quite different. Buried away in the figures, although there is scheduled to be some increase in spending on so-called protected departments, including health, what you find is that unprotected departments are now looking at a £20 billion cut. Now, this is absolutely devastating. There are already local councils out there, like Birmingham, on the verge of bankruptcy, or Havering in London, talking about having to turn off streetlights to save money. That's another £20 billion being thrown onto them and a whole load of other people. So that's the kind of expectations around it. That's what's just happened. It's more or less as everything was in November, and it's setting up an awful lot of very unpleasant cuts for whatever happens after the next election. Now, given the likelihood of Labour actually winning that election, if you look at the polls, the only real question is by how much will they win? It sort of starts to look a bit more interesting to think about what are Labour going to do to respond? Unusually, Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, has scheduled herself to go on a media round this Sunday of the various TV studios and provide a more considered response there. I'm delighted to have on the podcast Stella Chedikidou, who is herself a former Labour advisor, somebody I think we both at one point find ourselves rattling around the Palace of Westminster, trying to whisper words of advice in various MPs and Shadow Cabinet ministers' ears. First thing to ask, I suppose, is what did you make of it all?
What really impressed me with this budget is that you often get political pundits complaining that you either get, you very often will have bad politics preventing good policy from happening. And this budget was entirely both bad policy and bad politics. The entire thing felt to me like Jeremy Hunt is trying to set up traps for Keir Starmer, for Labour when they are in government. A lot of people have been saying George Osborne, nonetheless, in his very insidery podcast, how this is going to be Jeremy Hunt's last budget, that even if the Tories are going to win, he's not going to be the Chancellor, that they are widely expecting him to be replaced, which I don't think anyone thinks this is going to happen. But anyway, let's indulge this fantasy where there is some chance of them going back into government. So the main positive thing, to say something positive about this budget, is Jeremy Hunt tried to focus on productivity in public services, right? Which is great, very good thing. Yes, we should have, we should probably try to have more effective public services. But the rest of it is, as you said, there is this tax cut, which most people are not exactly going to be able to feel on the day to day. They will, they're a lot more likely to feel deteriorating public services and the insecurity that comes with that, and a lot of downstream problems that come from deteriorating public services. And how are they going to manage to do this tax cut? I work for a criminal justice charity. A big thing for us is children's services. I'm really scared of what they're going to do, especially when you're looking at the situation with local councils, when they're all completely cut to the bone. A lot of them are going to go bankrupt in the next year. I'm listening to Jeremy Hunt, and he was in such a jubilant mood the entire way through. Not just him, all the politicians, they seemed to be in a very, very good mood, given what they were actually delivering.
Yeah, I mean, look, there was a slight improvement in the Office of Budget Responsibilities forecast. I mean, that's kind of what possibly you cling on to as things that look better. You know, growth looks a bit better than they said back in November. Their forecasts for inflation look a bit better. As a result, households in general will be somewhat better off, for instance. But, I mean, one thing, these are all forecasts. This is where, you get slightly mad about a lot of the debate that we actually get on this stuff in Britain is it's incredibly short term. So you get these bad decisions, like if we cut something now, it won't have any impact into the future. I mean, that's being generous to the austerity program over the last 10 years. I think it was more maligned than that. But that was roughly the excuse. It's going to be fine if we cut now. We can sort of deal with it because we'll have economic growth in the future and everything's going to be fine. And of course, what actually happens is you cut, this damages economic growth, and then you get bad public services and low economic growth, and everyone's miserable for the next like 14 years. I mean, that's kind of the real product you get here. But it's an incredible short-termism, this fixation on and on about the headroom, this so-called headroom, this sort of engineering term that's been chucked in here as if this was a scientific process of some sort, which is, and all they mean by this is the difference between a target that the government has set for itself in 5 years' time of debt coming down relative to the size of the economy and what the OBR says in its forecast. So in other words, these are not even in economics terms real numbers. These are things, one of which the government controls entirely, it's its own target, and the other which is the Office of Budget Responsibility cranking a handle on its computer and seeing what turns up. I mean, it's just farcical to spend so long talking about this at the same time as the results of thinking that you need to focus on basically short-term, in many ways, completely fictitious measures of what's happening in the economy. The way you need to deal with that is then impose what amounts to £20 billion worth of additional cuts across so-called non-protected departments, like exactly local authorities. We've seen a 40% cut in real terms since 2010 or so. I mean, this is why you have Birmingham going bankrupt. This is why, exactly as you said, councils up and down the country are getting to the point of not being able to provide even the bare minimum services because they do not have the money to do it and they're running through the reserves. And as things stand, there is basically nothing, including the Labour Party, that's going to turn up and sort them out.
I agree. And one of the things that I'm starting to notice now, after 10 years of observing British politics, after like more than 10 years of being in this country, and I would love your help on this, James. Help me understand. And someone who is only ever so slightly older than me, but at the same time, someone who is a lot more economically literate than me. Can you explain to me this short-termism that you mentioned? I do not understand how it is after 10 years of austerity being seen as a perfectly acceptable political strategy, how is it that we have still not managed, as people who are into progressive politics, to counteract this narrative? Because here is my concern, right? And I see this in so many policies. I see this in the criminal justice sector. I see this in immigration. You have a narrative that we know is harmful and that we know is encouraging policies that are not effective, right? And then you have so-called progressive politicians who go with the flow, let's say, who pander to the right-wing media and accept that narrative being, you know, being tough on crime, tough on immigration, whatever, and then being pro-austerity and accepting that austerity is a reasonable or in any way effective economic policy. And rather than being brave and explaining to the public and doing the difficult thing, which is, you know, create an alternative narrative and explain to the public, they are not stupid, they will understand, explain to the public why austerity doesn't work. There are right-wing politicians, for God's sake, who will agree with this. It's not like it's just something that the left is saying. But they're not doing that. And then you have budgets like this one, where, again, they have this fantasy. So can you explain to me, as an economist, why is it so hard? Why is it so hard for politicians to explain this to the public? And don't the right-wingers also agree that you need to invest to grow?
Absolutely. I mean, by this point, you'll find any number of sort of people, even on the right of the Conservative Party, who will say things like, yes, we have to invest to grow and this sort of thing. And by the way, you'd find almost complete consensus, I would say, across economists by this point on a story that is something like austerity in a weak economy was a bad idea, and it was a bad idea over the last decade or so. It damaged economic growth, it undermined public services, it had no good outcomes. I mean, that I think is something close to a consensus amongst economists. So it's peculiar in that sense, because this isn't like 2010, where you found at least some economists to say maybe austerity is okay. Turned out they were wrong. And you would find actually quite a chunk of the public sitting there in about 2010 or so, believing a story pushed very assiduously by the Conservative Party at the time, which was that the nation's credit card is maxed out, a phrase I'm going to come back to. The nation's credit card is maxed out, we have to make cuts. And a lot of people believed that and went along with it. It's like, oh dear, there's a financial crisis. Oh dear, that's something to do with the Labour government. It kind of doesn't really make sense, but this is the story that people got hold of and took, and the government pushed it. The Tories pushed it in opposition, pushed it in government. What I find extraordinary, because 10 years on, more than 10 years on, it's now like 14 years of this rubbish, is that you find Keir Starmer, in his opening comments at the dispatch box, responding to Jeremy Hunt, says the national credit card is maxed out. Now, somebody in the leader's office probably thinks this is really super clever, right? This is parking your tanks on the Tories' lawn or something, but it's not. All you're doing is repeating your opponent's lines. You're not carefully reappropriating them and doing something else with it, because you're not. Because actually, Labour is signed up to those spending plans. They said nothing about how they're going to deviate from it. And those spending plans mean, as far as the Institute for Government, like the most reputable think tank out there, they sit in a very grand building just around the corner from Buckingham Palace. They're saying that across a range of public services they've surveyed, they think the service today is worse than it was in 2010, and it's set to get even worse from this point onwards as a result of the cuts. I mean, this is like the most respectable, the most insidery people recognise there's a problem here. And yet we're stuck with this kind of nonsense of austerity forever. So I think that the explanation here has to get you into something like it's an institutional failure. It's that we can have the whole public, most of the public, will say something like, now, they're not in favour of more austerity, because you can see what's happened. You'll find most economists who say they're not in favour of more austerity. You find the think tanks that look at how public services are performing, like your own, who say, not in favour of more austerity, we can't do it. And yet you have this Westminster driver that is pushing and pushing and pushing to try and make this happen. One part of it is the short-term political bit. Like, we know austerity is unpopular because the Tories haven't actually said they'll do it now. They're parking everything till after the election, which they're likely to lose. But why does Labour go along with it? I think in this case, it's because they see themselves as the party of the institutions. They see themselves as the people who are going to run these institutions competently, not change the institutions, run them competently, including the Treasury and including the Treasury's own biases towards spending cuts and austerity and balancing the books as they will see it. And they've swallowed that entirely. That's the kind of shortest explanation for that. There's a bigger story there, I think, about the role of financial services, the need to provide a cushion in cases of further financial crisis, the sort of things that George Osborne's old advisor, Rupert Harrison, tries to spell out as an explanation for austerity back in the 2010s. That's a sort of deeper reason. But fundamentally, it's because Labour see themselves as the people who will run the institutions competently, and those institutions are failing, they are in turn failing. They're just doing incompetent things more competently. They're doing stupid things competently. It's like, that's where Labour has got itself to. If they have any sense, they will take this opportunity to turn around and say how they are not going to drive through those public services. Because it's one thing for Tories to do this. Like, they have a voting bloc that sort of thinks, a fair old chunk of it is a bit like, yeah, okay, fine, spending cuts, we actually quite like that, thank you very much. A bunch of Tory supporters certainly think like that. On the Labour side, particularly after what we've seen in by-election last week, on the Labour side, that looks like a huge political risk apart from anything else. What do you think?
I think there is also a big fear of the media once again driving policy. And I see this on both political parties. They pay far, far more attention to what the headlines are and what the voters are watching. But I think that what we know from research, right, and the criminal justice sector has done research in this as well, actually the public is a lot more amicable to supporting progressive policies, even when it comes to criminal justice, where you would expect most of the public to say, yes, lock everyone up, blah, 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 be super tough on everyone. No, actually, the public is quite amicable. If you explain things to them, they will vote another way, they will agree, they will go with another policies, if the politicians are willing to do the hard work of setting out the right narrative. So I think what is going on there is a bit of a misunderstanding of the voters' priorities, right? So when you look at what are the voters' priorities, first is economy, second is the NHS, and sure enough, third one is immigration. Sure, fine. But if then you go to a voter and you explain to them the numbers and you tell them, look, the government just announced that they're going to give a few million pounds here and there for children's services, which they have done in this budget in the last couple of weeks, and more than half a billion pounds on shipping victims of torture to Africa, guess what the voter is going to tell you? They will tell you, what are you doing there? And by the way, like, I'm referring to the Rwanda policy here. It's not just that they're spending all of this money and that they have already spent all of this money, but it's something that's going to deal with less than 1% of asylum cases. And I'm not even going to go into the humanitarian issues around this, but surely if you explain this to a voter, if a politician was brave enough to explain this, to go and give an interview where they speak like a human being rather than an automate, like an AI robot or whatever, surely the voters are not stupid.
I don't think so. I mean, I agree with you that they're not, and that there's this sort of incipient desire to see things better, but it's so striking that this isn't now what we're getting. I mean, the other sort of political bit, I mean, look, the entire thing's political. We have this sort of rigmarole where budget and economics is presented as if it's a sort of technical science of, you know, austere decision making, and it's all for the good of the country. It's complete nonsense. It's all political. Budgets, especially so. That bit where Jeremy Hunt says, "Oh, okay, we're going to scrap the non-dom status," and that's going to raise really quite a lot of money. That's £2.7 billion for basically not allowing some rich semi-residents of the country to pay a sort of flat rate fee to live here rather than actually paying taxes due. So bye-bye non-dom status, £2.7 billion, which is a fair old whack of cash, particularly when things look a bit tight as they have been for Jeremy Hunt. But that's Labour's flagship policy. I mean, they were jamming everything, every bit of spending they had. They were having to lean it on the non-doms. Now that's gone. So what are Labour going to do? Because the other bit that's so peculiar about what's happened just over the last sort of probably 18 months or so is that they've been going around, the Labour leadership have been going around, steadily ruling out things that they could do. It says, no, we're not going to talk about wealth taxes in any form. We're not going to talk about equalising capital gains tax and income tax. Really, no-brainer one. I mean, the Tory Chancellor, Nigel Lawson, did this back in 1986. He said, instead of having people who work and pay income tax paying far higher tax than people who just like buy and sell antiques or go day trading or something like this, you know, your capital gain that you might pay on any gains there, you pay a much lower rate of tax, equalise the two. So what you get paying tax on work is the same as what you're paying on wealth. Perfectly simple thing to do. Raises huge amounts of money. I think at the top of my head, it's, you know, £80-90 billion over 5 years or so. Would pay for a lot of stuff. Very, very useful for Labour to do. They don't do any of this. They rule it out. So they box themselves in further and further and further. On the basis of what exactly? I mean, I think you're right. At least some of it is that a kind of fear of the media, that they think there's an easier course through this that just involves not rocking any boats and steady as she goes and keep everything bolted into place. I think there's also a degree to which it's driven by a very, very, this is the pure political part of it, driven by a very, very specific focus on a very, very few voters and a very few seats, and very, very specifically what those very few voters, typically in sort of so-called red wall seats, might think about things. A lot of this, by the way, I think is just not working. I mean, you know, driven by focus groups, for example. But I remember seeing a report from a focus group in Rochdale in which everybody in the focus group said, oh, we don't care about Gaza, we don't care about this, we care about local things. And then you get this thumping great result, clearly driven by Gaza and feelings around Gaza, you know, just a week later. So focus groups always take with a pinch of salt. But the other bit that's a bit of a miscalculation, I think, on the Labour side is that I don't think you can take people's votes for granted in quite that way anymore. You know, if you think back to 1997, a lot of people grumbled about Tony Blair, but he was quite genuinely popular, genuinely. Like, he built up a head of support for what Labour were going to do, and he did present a load of positive things about what they were going to do. Genuinely popular, and at the time, I don't think there was any real incentive or urge across most of the population to vote anything other than Labour if you're on the left. I mean, you can see that in the results. This time round, Right? Is Labour offering something big and positive? Is Keir Starmer as popular as Blair was in 1996, 97? Not by a long chalk. That's what the polls tell us. Is there anything positive there? No. Are people just going to carry on voting Labour? Well, quite likely a bunch of them are just not going to vote at all. I think turnout's going to be down. But there are clearly enough people out there that might think about voting for other parties to actually start to do some political damage. Now, Labour probably write that off. But the problem they then have is that then they're in office and having to potentially implement £20 billion worth of cuts. So what's that going to do to their support? And who's going to be the beneficiary from this? It just seems hopelessly, exactly as he said, sort of short-term, ill-considered. It's not thinking about what happens the day after the election. That's being generous to what they're doing this. It's not thinking about what you do afterwards, but how you spend your time in office, where political support might go, what might happen to that government over that period of time.
Yeah, exactly. And as you are saying, a lot of the things that you are mentioning, there are voters who understand them, firstly. So one thing that I like to do with my spare time is go on Times and read the comments underneath, and Financial Times and The Telegraph, but Times tends to be my favorite. And there are all sorts of people there, but a lot of them have really, really insightful comments to make. And a lot of them will point out exactly the things you are saying, like about capital gains tax and how unfair that is, how for a lot of people, their real wage has been cut over the years, exactly because of the frozen threshold on taxes. And because obviously most people have not been getting pay rises in line with inflation. So all of the things that you are saying, it's not like nobody understands them. Even Times readers, who you would expect to be more right-wing than the average voter than the Labour Party is trying to persuade, maybe. But still, they understand these things that you're saying. And when it comes to communication, we keep on going back to the same misunderstanding. We think that just because you ask a voter in a focus group, which for all of the reasons you just mentioned, is really not the way to make good policy. You ask them a question just because they believe something right now doesn't mean that they are not going to listen to a different narrative and a different argument. But if you never offer that argument, and you never paint that picture for the voter will never know. And you're going to be locked in a very ineffective, bad politics, which can only lead to bad policy, which is why I think that this budget was full of traps that the Labour Party is just going to get in.
I wanted to ask, actually, what do you think they're going to do? Because, we're recording this literally just as Jeremy Hunt has sat down and Keir Starmer has stood up. Very rude of us to start recording as he was still speaking, but here we are. So what's Labour going to do? You can ignore the response in Parliament, right? I think people don't realise this. You don't actually, if you're the opposition and you have to respond to the budget speech and the budget by the Chancellor, they don't actually give you that budget in advance. You see it slightly before everybody else sees it. You see the speech slightly before everybody else in heavily redacted form. So anything you say in Parliament has to be prepared in advance. It's not really going to be a response. I am wondering what Labour's going to do, because that £2.7 billion on the non-doms, which they were using to pay for what little spending they promised and various things, it's not nothing, you know, sort of breakfast clubs for kids, I think, a couple other things. That's gone. They were going to extend the windfall tax, actually, thinking about it, and oil and gas companies. Well, the Tories are now doing that, so that's sort of gone. So where does that leave their spending plans relative to the sacred fiscal rules that we're all apparently have to observe forevermore and do as we're told because of them? What are Labour going to do? Are they going to break their fiscal rules? Are they going to raise taxes? Or are they just going to go along with this?
The Shadow Front bench is going to have a very tough time doing the media rounds from tomorrow. Let me tell you that for sure. Especially because, you know, as you said, they have literally been using the non-dom tax for absolutely everything. So I think the argument that they're going to go back to is the fact that they can be very similar on policies right now. And behind the scenes, of course, Shadow Front bench has been saying, look, we have to be very, very fiscally tight. We have to be very strict. We cannot announce things now. And one can understand why, right? When they are saying, look, we announce something and then they go and they steal it. They say exactly the same thing. They have literally the Tories have stolen the vast majority of effective labor policies that have been announced in the last couple of years. But what they will say is, okay, yes, we are very similar, but you've had these guys in for 14 years. What have you got out of this? The Tories are saying, look, we're going to do pretty much similar things that we have been doing for the last few years, but we're going to do it more competently, because that's what they're insinuating. That's what Jeremy Hunt is insinuating when he's talking about productivity and making the public services more effective. He's talking about competence. He's saying, you know, trust me because I have a background in finance, whatever, and I'm wearing you know, a suit and whatever. So I think that the Labour Party line is going to be that, you know, I don't know if you saw the photo shoot that Rachel Reeves did, where she was, you know, had this incredibly strict haircut, and like it was all extremely, a very austere photo shoot. And I think this is what they're going for. They're saying, listen, you've had these other people for 14 years. You don't worry. We will, you know, we will keep the purse strings tight. We will just do it slightly better.
And do what? I mean, this is the thing that I start to go a bit mad. And then what will actually be different at this point? Like, what is the thing that's really going on the economy in particular? What's going to make a difference? Because the big thing they had, and it was genuinely big, was this £28 billion investment, which would have been very, very significant. I think it's slightly underestimated sometimes, just or underappreciated, just how big that would have been, right? This would have whacked Britain's very low rate of investment, lowest of any major developed economy, has been, God, for almost every year for the last, like, 40 or so. It would have whacked us right up into being one of the big spenders. It would have been transformational in various parts of the country. It was something that Labour could have said, we're going to do this. This means in bits of the country where there are not enough good jobs, it means good jobs for all sorts of things. It means doing something on the environment. It means, like, you can go through a list, right? And because it's a lot of money. And they just whittled it away and then got rid of it entirely. So what have they got left? I mean, what is their big economic promise here? So what if it's competent? What's the point of competently managing something that manifestly isn't working? Right? What's the point? Why would you turn around? Why would you say, I'm going to vote for that? Why can you turn around to someone and say, oh, you know, this is kind of shit. But imagine if the shit was being really well run. It's just pointless. And you can start to see, I think, where maybe not for the election, because I think Labour are going to win, and win probably not as big as some of the mad predictions are out there, but they're going to win. It's what you do afterwards. And it would not be, and this is something that's quite sort of, it's a political point, but it ought to alarm people. We are not in a world like 1997 where Labour can win, try for a few years to say that we're going to stick to Tory spending plans because we're fiscally responsible. And then actually, in credits Brown, you know, really start spending in public services, got the NHS back in its feet, sorted out the education system, all sorts of caveats, but they did spend money. They did turn things around. It was kind of good. All sorts of problems involved, which I don't have to go into now. But one of the things that they could rely on was a global situation that was very stable for them. The world economy was booming. The credit bubble was booming. Everything was good. Inflation's low, that sort of thing. Can you say that? No, no, you absolutely cannot. Not only do you have the legacy of 14 years of austerity and everything that has done. I mean, the repair budget for the NHS is £10 billion just to clear the backlog of repairs. Where's Labour promising to even fix leaky roofs in hospitals or schools that are falling apart? Where's the money to do that? There's nothing there. And then you chuck it into a situation where the economy is actually not going to grow at anything like the clip it has done in the past. Here, same across Europe, and take that as read. And you've got a significant amount of debt and debt interest rates. The cost of everything has gone up. Inflation's still high. And I think those forecasts that the OBR presents are over-optimistic, by the way. So what are you going to do? You're just wandering into a crisis situation going, we'll manage this competently. You have nothing there. I don't think they understand just how bad things are. At least that's the only way to sort of rationalize this. And they don't have any sense of how bad things are going to get if you're not doing anything about it.
The only solution is ignore the media completely and produce good policy and try to actually create an alternative narrative. And what will happen is they will start announcing things. But I think a good opportunity for the Labour Party is to take a bold position on foreign policy and make foreign policy and foreign affairs the main thing for them. Because it is a time when, you know, with everything that's happening in the Middle East and in Russia, this is a time where a country like the UK really needs to take some bold decisions on who we will be supporting and how. And there's obviously a lot of controversy there. But where I advising the Labour Party right now, I would say, make sure, if you are so worried about media, do some good coverage in terms of foreign affairs, and then adopt better fiscal policy by investing more without making, you know, lots of fanfare, and try to ignore the right-wing media when they come to you every time you're announcing that you're investing into something. But sadly, this is a message that politicians have not yet managed to get. You need to ignore the media sometimes.
I think as things stand, probably foreign policy is the thing that Labour needs to keep away from and would like to keep very quiet about. I mean, like, it's the one thing that has really undermined Keir Starmer over the last sort of 6 months or so, for obvious reasons, the appalling scenes in Gaza, right? But if I want to take a bit of that and sort of take the economics end of that, I mean, I suppose it's the one thing that Labour have that they might do. You know, we're just all parking this budget. It's probably the last one of this parliament. Probably there's still going to be an election in October. That didn't feel like this whiz-bang budget. They're going to go straight into the election that they're going to win. I don't think so. So October election or thereabouts. The one thing that Labour has left to do where competence might play a part is revise the deal we signed with the EU and has been implemented since early 2020, the Trade and Cooperation Act agreement. And that's up for renegotiation in 2025. So one of the first things they'll have to do is renegotiate it. It would not be hard to get a low-cost, better deal than one we actually got with Boris Johnson. And at least in theory, doing this would start to unlock a bit of growth, right? And that is something that potentially, if I was sitting in, you know, Labour headquarters or sitting in, I wonder if they're still in those same rubbishy rooms that you had in the Palace of Westminster. If you're sitting in there with the carpet peeling and the paint coming off the walls and all the rest of it, if you're sitting in there thinking about how you're going to measure up the curtains in number 10, I suspect that part of what they want to do is go, actually, we're going to renegotiate with the European Union and this will unlock investment and all the rest of it. Now, that ties in perfectly with the general story about competent management. And it looks to me like one of the very few things where a story of competent management might actually produce some goods. But the problem they've got is, okay, so you have a bit more economic growth. If you get a bit more economic growth in 2 years' time because you've got better deal with the EU, 2 years after 2025, so that's 2027, that's doing nothing for the fact that you're children's school is crumbling away in front of you, or that you can't get a hospital appointment if you're not prepared to wait for 16 hours or whatever. That it doesn't do anything for this. So this fixation and growth without, as far as I can tell, a real attempt to turn it back into what does this mean for people right now? How are you going to deliver something for people right now is where they're actually going to come a cropper. Because my own strong suspicion is that even if people are patient, even if they can do the 1997 thing, of basically, we will trust Labour to do things better in a few years, spending will increase. That's what Labour did in 1997. They stuck to strict spending limits from the Tories and then increased spending after a few years. Even if people had that patience, I don't think the state of things is such that they'll just allow this to pass and everything will work out in the future. I don't think that's how people feel about the future. And I think in a chaotic world like the one we're in, it's as likely as not you hit some crisis, either some big external thing, of which climate change is increasingly likely to be a big external thing, or it's some internal crisis because it's another winter crisis in the NHS or whatever, and you have nothing set up to deal with that. You are not politically prepared to deal with that. You've not said how you're going to spend any more money. You've just said you're going to competently manage the kind of the pile of crap that we already have. And that is a point where things look very difficult, I suspect, for the next Labour government.
In a way, and I don't want to jinx it, like knock on wood, but the thing that would actually help Keir Starmer is if there was a big destructive event that happened once he was in government, because it would allow him to do a Rishi Sunak with it out to help out and all of these other wasteful policies that Rishi Sunak decided to do, like not like wasteful, like furlough, obviously super important that he did that, but he was allowed to basically act as if he's a Labour politician rather than, you know, a very right-wing tax-cutting, austerity, blah, blah, blah kind of politician. So in a way, I think that would be, I don't know, that would be something that would help Keir Starmer is if something really big happened, which could, you know.
I mean, it's sort of stripping out the cynicism there, if you like, Stella. I mean, but there is something to this, because I think something like that will happen. Now, you can't really say, oh, yeah, there was some doom and gloom, some terrible events going to take place. Look, in a very chaotic world, I mean, you can go through a list of things that might happen that are expensive and need patching up, right? Major floods is an obvious one. Another outbreak of foot and mouth. You can just go through a list. A financial crisis. It's another sparking for a financial crisis in some form. And there are many, many different routes that might take because things are fragile at the minute. And by the way, financial crisis has an interaction now with climate change. That, you know, there's this growing risk in the insurance sector because lots and lots of insurers can't provide house insurance on people in places like, taking a US example, Florida or California, because you have wildfires, you have floods, you have all these sort of extreme weather events, can't provide insurance, you're losing loads of money as an insurance company. This is an incipient financial crisis, for example. Lots and lots of different routes where this might happen now. That could take place. Something like that happened to the last Labour government. that 2007, 2008, you hit the financial crisis. Gordon Brown as Prime Minister, Alice Darling as Chancellor, have to run massive deficits, end up basically bailing out the banks and doing lots of things that weren't quite so bright in many, many different ways. Don't need to retread that entire history of the last sort of 15 years, whatever it is. But nonetheless, they were forced to run big deficits and act in an emergency capacity. Did it do them any good in the following election? No, it didn't. And this is the other bit, is that there's a sort of version of events where it proves impossible for Labour to actually stick to this austerity. I mean, anybody who's sitting in the public sector will tell you it's not going to be possible to do more cuts. You just can't do it. So they're going to have to break their own rules. What will that do when you've spent 12 months at least before the election going, these are the most sacred things that exist. We cannot have any more spending than this. Right? It turns you over politically. And you can say, oh, it's a crisis. And it's like, yeah, but like the other lot are going to blame you for that crisis and it's going to land on you and you haven't prepared for it. And I see no evidence that they prepared for it. It's quite uncanny watching this play out. I mean, just on the lack of preparation, the £28 billion. They announced this when interest rates were low. They seem to not have planned for what might happen if interest rates go up. And as a result, there's a sort of panic and they have to get rid of it and it costs them. It politically costs them. So it would have been better to not announce it in the first place, or even better still, to have actually thought about what you might do to make sure that £28 billion is still there if interest rates and inflation goes up. And they didn't seem to do this. So they're kind of, I don't think they're thinking longer term. I don't think they're thinking about what might go wrong.
Politically, with the £28 billion, right, what they were trying to do is this bomb-proofing thing that they keep on banging on about that Tony Blair used to do. You know, every time there was an election, he would take the manifesto and he would go into a quiet hotel room, whatever, and he would go through it line by line and bomb-proof it to make sure that there is nothing that the right-wing media can jump on and can hit him with it. But and a lot of commentators have said, oh, it was wrong to begin with that Rachel Leaves put a number on it because she gave, again, this paralyzing fear of, oh, we're giving something to the right-wing media to fight us, blah, blah. Okay, whatever. Yes, sure, they have something. And it is true that figure has been doing the rounds for the longest time, and the Shadow Front bench has had to constantly explain where the Labour Party is going to find the money to do this investment when, you know, you have the economy going the way it does. So one could say, okay, right, you don't want to give any numbers, your values remain the same, you're saying that you want to do green investment, you are saying that you agree that it's a good thing, and everyone seems to be on board these days in terms of green investment, as far as I can see, because it, you know, the CBI was asking Rachel Reeves to keep the £28 billion. It's not like, you know, it's not like big business was against this sort of investment. So I guess one could say, oh, the values are going to remain the same. It's just that you pre-election, you're too scared to put a number on it because you don't want to have to defend it. Maybe that's that. My problem is going back to the narrative that you are still accepting that austerity is necessary. And if you're accepting that austerity is necessary, later down the line, once again, you will have to work in the framework that you have accepted for yourself. And this is not going to end. This is why it is very important, I think, that people like yourself, who have an economics background and can explain this thing, put out this alternative narrative. You never know who is listening. Eventually it will catch on. People will hear it once from you, they will hear it another time from someone else. Eventually people will start understanding what's the bigger picture, rather than all of these sound bites that they're continually being fed by GB News and the Daily Mail and everybody else.
And on that bombshell, Stella Chedekidu, former Labour advisor, current political commentator, thank you very much for joining Macrodose for this immediate spring budget discussion.
Thank you, James. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Macrodose is a Planet B production. If you enjoyed the show and you'd recommend it to friends, please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all our episodes, including our bonus interview content, on our Patreon at patreon.com/macrodose.